From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins. Sitting in today for Tony is our own Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships for Family Research Council.
Welcome to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships here at Family Research Council, filling in for Tony Perkins today. In recent years, the Democratic Party has become the first major party in American history to explicitly court non-religious voters at the expense of people of faith, a previously unthinkable development because religious freedom is a founding principle of this country. In just a minute, I'll talk with Luke Goodrich from Beckett Law on his book, Free to Believe, The Battle Over Religious Liberty in America. In my next two segments, I'll interview Mike Lindell, a Christian businessman who escaped a crack cocaine addiction and overcame incredible odds to become the founder and CEO of the very successful company MyPillow. He also played a role in the pro-life movie Unplanned. More on that soon. And at 42 past the hour, a heads up for parents. If your child has access to technology, you'll want to listen. I'll speak with Kathy Haddam, Communications Director of Enough is Enough, about apps predators use to target children. Some of them might surprise you. As a reminder, visit our podcast website at tonyperkins.com. Follow Tony on Twitter at tperkins or me at Sarah P. Perry. Well, politicians on the left have become increasingly hostile to religion in America. They show little to no tolerance for those who seek to protect the unborn, to uphold the traditional family structure, to adhere to traditional religious orthodoxy. And in fact, the Democratic National Committee went so far as to even pass a resolution celebrating religiously unaffiliated voters and condemning religious liberty as code words for discrimination against many groups, including LGBT individuals. Now, joining us to rebut these allegations is Luke Goodrich, Vice President and Senior Counsel of Beckett Law Firm, a firm devoted to defending religious liberty against unwarranted and unconstitutional attacks. He is a leading attorney and has won multiple Supreme Court victories for clients like the Little Sisters of the Poor and Hobby Lobby. He frequently discusses religious freedom on networks such as Fox, CNN, NPR, and in publications like the New York Times and Wall Street Journal. He's an adjunct professor at the University of Utah Law School, where he teaches an advanced course in constitutional law. Luke, welcome to Washington Watch.
Sarah, thank you so much for having me.
So your book is Free to Believe, The Battle Over Religious Liberty in America. And in it, you use your legal experience and some of your incredible victories at the Supreme Court to address the issue, to really give a primer to the American reader about why religious liberty is important and what can be done to protect it. And you do it in such a graceful way. We are so grateful that you've written this book. It's so necessary. But I do want to answer that question specifically before I go into some of the contents of the book. Why do you believe that an understanding of religious freedom matters so intensely to the American people?
Well, Americans are waking up to the fact that religious freedom is under attack in ways that it hasn't been under attack before. But we don't always understand exactly what the threats are or how they're going to play out in court or in our everyday lives. So the reason I wrote Free to Believe is so that ordinary Americans can understand. You know, they may not have a decade of experience litigating these issues in court, but ordinary Americans can understand what religious freedom is, why it matters, how is it under attack, and what can we do about it. So that's what I was trying to accomplish in Free to Believe.
And I have to imagine that your very lengthy, very deep experience at the Supreme Court arguing on specifically this issue in defense of your clients had to inform a lot of what you wrote. And that, I think, for someone who is picking up your book for the first time, really gives a very close perspective on what this issue looks like from a very sort of microscopic level. You are representing clients who are dealing with this issue specifically. And as you talk about, it's very hard for the average person to follow all of the developments at the Supreme Court, let alone the developments on the notion of religious liberty. So was there a particular instance in your years of history in front of the Supreme Court that made you really decide now is the time to write a book of this type?
I've had the privilege of participating in four cases at the Supreme Court for clients like the Little Sisters of the Poor and Hobby Lobby. I think one of the most significant experiences I had was a lesser-known case called Hosanna Tabor, and that was a case where a small Lutheran church in Michigan was sued, allegedly for discrimination, because it dismissed one of its teachers for violating church teaching. And we took this case up to the Supreme Court, and at the Supreme Court, it was 2012, and the Obama administration took an extreme position that basically churches and all religious organizations should get no special constitutional protections when they're hiring their pastors and teachers and other leaders. It was an extreme attack on religious freedom. And we stood up for that Lutheran church in Michigan, argued that churches need to be free to hire their leaders without government interference. And thankfully, we won a 9-0 victory at the U.S. Supreme Court. But attacks like that that you saw from the Obama administration are increasingly common. And it's very important for Christians, everyday Christians, you know, not in legalese, but to understand where these attacks are coming from and what we can do about it.
So answer the question as to whether or not religious freedom is really sort of a veiled reference to Christian dominance or sort of a theocratic form of government. Is that really what we're trying to communicate when we use terms like religious liberty?
Not at all. And I do think, however, Christians often don't have a deep theological or philosophical understanding of religious freedom. And we know that religious freedom allows us as Christians to promote the gospel in our workplaces, in our houses of worship. But what I try to argue and show in Free to Believe is that religious liberty is more than that. It's not just about protecting our rights and creating a safe space for us to live out our faith, although that's a very important benefit. Religious freedom goes much deeper than that. It's actually a fundamental issue of biblical justice rooted in the nature of God and how God chooses to relate with us. And so when the government steps in into that relationship between God and human beings, the government is usurping its God-given place, and it's really trying to put itself in the place of God, and that is a significant form of injustice.
So in your book, you discuss some of the most pressing religious freedom challenges, and it's an excellent catalog of some of the more recent cases, what we've seen progressively over the years. And really, it's a little sobering to take everything in the aggregate because you realize that this is an increasing pattern of hostility. So the other issue we hear so often, if we're not hearing that this is Christian dominance or theocratic governance, what we hear often is that it is code for discrimination. And most often, the notion of religious liberty comes up squarely against sexual orientation and gender identity. So to say religious liberty, is that really just a code word for discrimination?
You're exactly right. That's one of the main charges leveled against Christians and against religious freedom today, is that it's simply code for discrimination. And in my work at Beckett, we're currently litigating a case, taking it up to the Supreme Court on behalf of a Christian foster care agency in the city of Philadelphia. And that agency has been taking care of foster kids for over 100 years. And the city of Philadelphia recognizes there's a foster care crisis, there's a need for more families, and yet at the same time, it is said it is going to cut off this agency, this Christian organization, shut them down, and stop them forever from placing children in foster homes. merely because the city of Philadelphia disagrees with their Christian religious beliefs about marriage, because this Christian organization won't place foster children with same-sex couples. And the real harm from actions like this is, yes, to the Christian organization, but even more to children, foster children,
right,
who need loving homes and who are benefited when Christians are able to do the caring work that they've been doing for over 100 years. So that's the kind of argument that we're confronting in court every day. And I try to just break it down very clearly in the book. What are the arguments? Where are the threats coming from? What are the best responses? And what can we do to be free to continue carrying out the work of the gospel?
So the left talks frequently as a basis for much of their disagreement on the notion of religious liberty about this sort of mystical separation of church and state. And for some of us who are unschooled on the notion of religious liberty, to hear separation of church and state, it's sort of a catchy phrase. It's pithy enough to be remembered and often cited as a basis for why there can be no expression of faith in the public square. But really, that's a misunderstanding of the principle itself, isn't it?
Yes. I'm litigating a case right now in Florida where citizens in the city of Pensacola, over 70 years ago, they put up a cross in a public park on Easter morning because they wanted to pray for our country as it stood on the verge of World War II. And an atheist organization, 70-some-odd years later, has sued, arguing that it violates the separation of church and state to have a cross on government property. And the Supreme Court recently upheld a different cross in Maryland, and I think it's headed in the right direction on these issues. But you definitely have a current in society right now that is seeking to invoke the idea of separation of church and state to really scrub religion from the public square. And what I argue in my book, Free to Believe, is that we know Christianity is true. We don't need the government to prop it up in any particular way, but neither should the government try to scrub religion from the public square. It should treat religion as a natural and valuable part of human life and of the public square, and it should try to leave religion as uninfluenced by government power as possible. And so, we don't have to be allergic to the phrase separation of church and state, even though it's not in the Constitution. But separation of church and state doesn't mean scrubbing religion from the public square. It means the government leaves religion as uninfluenced by government power as possible and allows religion to flourish.
What an excellent summary of what is necessary moving forward and an understanding of some of the catchphrases, some of the summaries that we hear when we're referring to a concept important enough to be enshrined in a founding document of this country, but so often misunderstood and increasingly under attack. The book is Free to Believe, The Battle Over Religious Liberty in America. Luke Goodrich has been my guest today, senior counsel for the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty. It's available everywhere books are sold. You're listening to Washington Watch. Coming up, an incredible story of redemption from a businessman you've probably heard of. We'll be right back.
Did you know that Family Research Council just published a new series on forming a biblical worldview? In these publications, David Clawson, Director of Christian Ethics and Biblical Worldview at FRC, addresses the complex moral questions and issues prevalent in our society today. Clawson discusses the biblical basis behind these moral issues and urges Christians to stand firm on the foundational truths of the Bible. Today, there is widespread biblical illiteracy. Americans are unaware of what the Bible says, and even professing Christians have difficulty defending a biblical ethic. As a result, Christian beliefs are increasingly dismissed as outdated or even seen as hateful. The Biblical Worldview series seeks to bridge this gap by solidifying Christians in their biblical worldview so they are ready to give an answer for the hope that is in them. The first three publications in this series discuss the biblical and historical basis for life, religious liberty, and political engagement. To learn more, visit frc.org/worldview.
We live in a time of great political division, and this division only intensifies during campaign season. The toxic tone in politics can be discouraging, which makes it a very real temptation for many Christians to wipe their hands of politics altogether. After all, if God is sovereign and controls the heart of the king, as Proverbs says, do we really need to get involved in the messy world of politics? Because political engagement can be divisive, shouldn't Christians abandon politics and direct their energies toward more spiritual pursuits? Christians are called to submit every area of their life to God, which includes how they engage in politics. But they are called to engage biblically. This requires Christians to be prepared to follow their political theology to its logical end and vote for candidates and parties that support clear biblical values. For more information on the Christians' call to engage in politics, visit frc.org/engage. That's frc.org/engage.
Religious liberty is one of the most important yet misunderstood issues in America. There's a growing perception that protecting religious liberty is an attempt to lawfully allow bigotry and prejudice. Therefore, Christians need to be able to articulate with greater clarity and persuasiveness why they support religious liberty. Biblical Principles for Religious Liberty, Evidence from Scripture and Church History, is a new publication from Family Research Council that presents biblical and theological arguments for why religious liberty is worth defending and encourages Christians to engage in the fight to preserve America's first freedom. This publication presents key biblical texts that support a broad understanding of religious freedom and key theological arguments based on those texts. In an increasingly secular world, Christians must understand and advocate for religious liberty. Learn more by visiting frc.org/belief.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships here at Family Research Council, filling in for Tony Perkins today. Well, as Christians, we at FRC believe everyone is capable of redemption, and everyone loves a good redemption story. Today, we're going to hear the incredible journey of Mike Lindell, founder and CEO of MyPillow, who recently has come into the news as being one of the financiers and producers of the pro-life movie Unplanned. His redemption story is out in his new book, From Crack Addict to CEO. Mike, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thanks for having me on. This is awesome.
So I love your openness and vulnerability. First of all, I just love the approachability in this story, but the story itself is truly mind-numbing. It is one of those stories where you think there is no coming back from this until God says, oh, no, this is not where the story ends. So can you share a little bit about your personal journey with us?
Yeah, it goes back now. I know, where all my addiction and everything comes from. And my parents divorced when I was 7, back when divorces were not common. And I was put into a new school and became very either kind of introvert, shy, or I would show off, jump out bus windows. Hey, kids, watch me, at my 5-year reunion, in fact, I had dropped out of college, and at our 5-year reunion, they're all finishing, they had finished college, started families, and maybe with the same job. And I was working at a drive-in movie theater and a grocery store still. And I took over the reunion talking about, I got 17 traffic tickets in 2 days out running the cops. I owe the mafia all this money for football bets. I crashed a motorcycle going skydiving, and then I finally got down there to skydive and my parachute didn't open. But when I got home that night after that reunion and laying in bed, I'm going, I just had this ick feeling that, I wanted what they had. And I think all those things that happen, I think addiction, comes from childhood, comes from trauma, comes from father wounds and stuff. And then about the mid-80s, I found cocaine. Well, then I could actually talk to people. You don't get rejected if you don't talk to people.
Sure.
So you don't have to have that fear. Well, I could now talk to people. And then I was a very functioning cocaine addict, raised a family 20 years, had four kids and very functioning at it, but we owned a bar. We had bought, I'd always been an entrepreneur. I bought a bar and that wasn't a real good place for an addict. And,
right.
But then in the early 2000s, it switched to crack cocaine. And anybody out there on crack, I mean, it's a very different drug than cocaine. It's you get paranoia and it kind of got me down. It basically drove me losing the bar. And then about the same time, God gave me a dream of a pillow. And I had this, I got upstairs. I wrote My Pillow. First it came to me, the name My Pillow. And I had it wrote all over upstairs about 2 a.m. And my daughter came. She came up there and she goes, she's like 10 years old. She goes, what are you doing? I said, I'm going to invent this pillow. It's going to change the world. It's going to be called My Pillow. And she grabbed a glass of water. She looked at me. She goes, that's really random, Dad, and went back downstairs.
Wow.
And but both of that, then it was a parallel track. I did get the pillow invented, but I was turned down everywhere. And someone said, Mike, why don't you do a kiosk? I said, how do you spell that? And I ended up doing this kiosk. And I couldn't be there to talk to people because, once again, I couldn't talk to people if I wasn't straight, or if I was straight. So my wife at the time did most of the selling, but I was there the one day, and this guy, he bought a pillow and he said, do you have a business card? I said, no, I'm all out. And here I wrote my number on a piece of paper. I didn't have any business cards. And he called me that January. You know, there's so many divine appointments. He called me and he said, are you the guy that invented this pillow? I said, yes. He goes, well, this changed my life. This is the best product I've ever tried. And I run the Minneapolis Home and Garden Show. Would you like a spot in there? And when I got in there, I had no money left and mortgaged our house to buy Christmas presents for the kids. And we had nothing left. I went into that show and I said, well, I put a table between me and the people and I changed my signage. And I did it myself this time, and it was hard because it was hard to talk to people, you know. But the next day, people came back that had bought pillows, and they came up to me, and they go, "This pillow changed my life." And for me, it's never been about the money. From that moment on, it made me feel so good inside that I had helped people, it was just I just fed off of that. But I did shows and fairs then for the next 5 or 6 years because no box stores would take me. And that was a parallel railroad track with crack addiction. And I lost a 20-year marriage. I had people try to take the company many times. And they, what little of it there was. And the pillow company was just a little pulse. And then in 2008, actually my drug dealers did an intervention. I was downtown Minneapolis and I came out of the room and I had been up for 14 days and they said, Mike, we're cutting you off. You've been up for 14 days. And I'm arguing with them. I've only been up for 12. So two of them leave. And the one guy sat there and he waited till 2 a.m. And finally he fell asleep and I headed down to the streets of Minneapolis. And I said, and I get down there and I couldn't get crack anywhere. Nobody would sell to me. I came back upstairs and that guy took a picture of me. He said, give me your phone. I'm going to take a picture of you. He said, you've been telling us for years that this pillow is just a platform for God and you're going to come back and help us all someday. I would tell these guys this all the time. And then, anyway, he goes, we're not going to let you die on us. So I was like their hope, you know,
wow.
I was like their hope. And two of them work for me, by the way. They're born again Christians.
Oh my gosh. Mike Lindell, I gotta put you on hold. We have to go to a break. Let me tell you, there is so much more to this incredible story and the way God has just transformed your life so that you can transform other lives through his power is exceptional. Mike Lindell of MyPillow, author of the book From Crack Addict to CEO, is my guest. We'll be right back after this on Washington Watch.
News. We can get it from many sources, but what can you trust these days? Where can you get news that doesn't make you as suspicious as you are informed? If you're looking for something better, for honest coverage of the latest news, one trusted news source I look to is the Washington Times. When preparing for the radio program and selecting guests to join me on the show, I will often read the Washington Times and have their reporters join me here on the program because I trust how they cover the news. Join me and more than 7 million readers who turn to the Washington Times every month to get real, trusted news. For a limited time only, listeners of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins will receive a special annual rate of $69.95 for the first year. Subscribe to the Washington Times and get this special offer by using my name and visiting washingtontimes.com/Tony Perkins. That's washingtontimes.com/Tony Perkins.
Radical abortion laws in New York, Illinois, and Vermont are challenging the sanctity of life. These laws have lifted the few existing restrictions on abortion in the name of family planning and mental health of pregnant mothers. Americans need to take a stand and defend the rights of the unborn. Family Research Council is sending Congress 90,000 baby hats as a reminder that babies should be welcomed with love and warmth, not potential danger. Supporters have already funded over 45,000 hats. We are over halfway there. Join Americans across the nation and donate $9 to send a powerful reminder that young lives need to be cherished. When you take action, we'll send you an end birthday abortion certificate that will remind you to pray for born alive babies who are facing the danger of being killed outside the womb. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com for more information. That's endbirthdayabortion.com.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins here at the Family Research Council. So we're sitting here with Mike Lindell, CEO of MyPillow, and also a producer in the pro-life movie Unplanned, who was a major financier, and he's sharing his incredible story of recovery. So we talked a little bit about your personal story. Talk to me now about what you're doing with this charitable work. You have this incredible recovery, and it's so bad, your dealer is actually saying, I'm not going to feed this addiction anymore. So the business has grown. It takes off. What are you doing now with the business? Because I know you also run a foundation.
Right. Well, what I did back then when I ended up quitting January 16, 2009, and I knew at that point when I did quit that it wasn't about the pillow. It was about this platform that I had, and that calling was going to be gone forever. Well, now, obviously my pillow got huge. I got this, God gave me this big platform. And what I'm doing now is called the Lindell Recovery Network. And what this is, it's going to be the most, when I launch this, the most amazing platform for addicts in history. What I'm doing and putting out, you put in your age and what you're addicted to. And all these stories, and they're not stories of bottoms, they're just commonality of the drug, come across. So let's say you put a 22-year-old opiate addict. All these 22-year-old opiate addicts come up that are, you don't know how they're set free, but you see they tell their thing about, what they didn't like about the drug when they were an addict. But every one of them has made it through, and you're going, how did they get there? It's like all these stories of hope. Mm. Well, in order for these addicts to get the help, they have to go to a church. I vetted over 2,000 churches now where they'll go there and they'll get this code. They have to sit through a service. They'll get a code. That will open up this app. And when you open it up, you're going to have all this online, my mentors I have that are going to be their age, and they're going to be talking. It's just like when you're talking to someone, if the commonality, like for me, a guy that helped me back then was my same age. We had both done the same drug and everything, and he had found Jesus 3 years earlier. Mm. Now, if you see someone that's the exact age and the same commonality of the drug, you resonate with that. Then all the help, I'm going to have all the help vetted the last 2.5 years. I have vetted over 3,500 treatment centers that work.
Wow.
I want to list that part, that work. These are all your faith-based, meaning Jesus. These are your Teen Challenge, your Union Gospels, your Salvation Armies, your St. Matthew's House in Florida. These are all over here. They have an 80-some percent success rate versus your secular treatment centers, which are just horrible. They're just monetizing addiction. And now these people, the addicts go, they go there. So I'm basically showing them, getting them to church and to help. And you're getting there through they see stories of hope, like people see me, but now they see them their own age. And then I have another thing called Life Relaunch, and that's going to be a two-day program, which that one we've been doing for a couple of years, where in the prisons and for addicts both. But that's how you get your heart restored. You find Jesus in 2 days. It's just amazing.
Oh,
and
wow.
That's going to be it. That's an on. So it's the whole platform. That's why I'm pre-launching my book early, from crack addict to, or what are the odds, from crack addict to CEO. I'm pre-launching to get those funds so I can launch the Lindell Recovery Network as fast as I can this fall.
Oh, my gosh. What an incredible story to take what your success has been and use it to just continue to multiply it over and over again. You've gotten involved with the movie Unplanned. You took on the project because it spoke to you, and there was something about it that really sort of spoke to your individual passion. We've got about 2 minutes left, but how did you get involved with the project?
Yeah, I'll tell you that one real quick. I was on my way to Israel. We were in the tarmacs in New York City, and I get a call from a guy I hadn't talked to in 3 years. He goes, Mike, this is Michael, whatever, and he says, I'm here with two producers, and we prayed about this, and you're going to be in our movie. And I said, what, like an actor? And he said, yeah. And I said, okay, well, I didn't pray about it. What's in the movie? And he tells me about this true story of Abby Johnson with worked for Planned Parenthood, found out what was going on and just left. And I got off the phone. I prayed with my gal. I got called him back in 1 minute. I said, I'll be in it. I said, I want it to be the best movie, you know, a quality movie, not just a best, you know, you know, the message being great, but I also want the movie to be great. And
right.
They said, are you short any money? They said, well, we're short $1 million. And I said, just a minute. I wired the money on faith. I had no idea, you know,
within
5 minutes, wired the money. And then I find out later that God told them that, because that was 0 hour. If they didn't get the money, the movie wouldn't be here. And they said, call Mike Lindell. Well, you know what? You look at God's timing on that by me listening. And the timing of that movie was like, you couldn't have timed it any better with, you know, killing babies killing unborn in New York and killing babies in Virginia. You know, I mean, the timing was just critical.
Mike, I am so impressed with your story. I'm impressed more with your heart, your responsiveness to the leading of the Holy Spirit. You've got to get the book, listeners. What are the odds from crack addict to CEO? Mike's website is MichaelJLindell.com. You are listening to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins here at Family Research Council. Coming up next, Kathy Haddam, Director of Communications for Enough is Enough, to discuss apps on your child's phone that predators use to target them. We'll be right back.
Today, more than ever, there is a need to pass fetal dignity laws. In 2010, the police raided the abortion clinic of Dr. Kermit Gosnell and discovered jars with the remains of unborn babies. In 2019, another abortionist, Dr. Ulrich Klopfer, was exposed for hiding the remains of thousands of unborn babies in plastic bags in the trunk of his old car. And in 2015, videos from the Center for Medical Progress uncovered an industry where aborted baby body parts are being harvested and sold for research. The trafficking of aborted babies funds the abortion industry and incentivizes harmful practices such as late-term abortion, altering abortion methods solely to preserve remains for sale, violating patient privacy, and even killing children born alive in order to harvest their organs. All states should ensure the respectful burial of unborn children killed in abortion and prohibit the sale and trafficking of baby body parts. To learn more about fetal dignity laws, visit frc.org/fetal dignity.
Hello, this is Tony Perkins, President of the Family Research Council here in Washington, D.C. I want to invite you to join Luana and myself, along with Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin, former Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann, for FRC's Israel Tour, June the 2nd through June the 12th, 2020. Whether you're sailing on the Sea of Galilee, standing in the ruins of Capernaum, or journeying up to Jerusalem, Israel is unlike any other place on earth. You'll relive the final earthly days of Jesus as you pray in the Garden of Gethsemane. You look upon Golgotha and stand in the Garden Tomb. The reality of his story will come alive in a transformative way. This one-of-a-kind tour will not only allow you to explore the land of the Bible and the roots of our Christian faith, you'll also hear firsthand from some of Israel's political, defense, and religious leaders. Join us June the 2nd through June the 12th for this life-changing experience. For more information, visit TonyPerkins.com or call 844-872-5155.
Abortion is one of the most combative and sensitive moral and political questions in America today, even among Christians. There has been a renewed effort in theological liberal Christian circles to argue that the Bible does not oppose abortion. In light of these arguments, it is crucial for Christians to know what the Bible actually says about abortion. Does the Bible teach that life begins at conception or birth? Is abortion murder? In FRC's new publication titled Biblical Principles for Pro-Life Engagement, Personhood, Scripture, and Church History, author David Clausen addresses these questions with relevant passages in the Bible that inform how a Christian should think about abortion, the question of personhood, and a survey of how prominent church leaders have interpreted these passages throughout history. Learn more by visiting frc.org/unborn. That's frc.org/unborn.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships here at Family Research Council, filling in for Tony today. As a reminder, our podcast can be found on TonyPerkins.com. There you'll find action steps, links, resources, and guest information for today's broadcast. Follow Tony on Twitter at TPerkins or me at Sarah P. Perry. Well, there are plenty of reasons parents should be concerned about how much time their kids spend on their smartphones. Less screen time can improve mental health, physical health, learning, development, attention span. But parents who want to protect their children should also care how they spend their phone time. Sexual predators can actually use a variety of apps to target children through technology. Joining me now to explain more is Kathy Haddam, Communications Director for Enough is Enough, an organization that seeks to make the internet safer for children and families. Kathy, welcome to Washington Watch.
Sarah, thanks so much for having me today.
So on your website, which I want to tell our listeners is enough.org, that's enough.org, your organization shared a very compelling and memorable graphic from the Sheriff's Department in Sarasota County, Florida, warning parents about 15 apps that were potentially dangerous. Can you tell us a little bit about this list and where it came from?
Absolutely. And first of all, I want to just give a hats off to the Sarasota Sheriff's Office for sharing this information because it's such a great reminder for parents and caregivers anywhere that the apps and items that kids use or teens use every day, they spend hours and hours consuming, they may be familiar to all of us just by looking at an icon or symbol, and they may be seemingly innocent on the outside, but what we're all learning, of course, is that that's not always the case. And so I'm really glad that they gave us an opportunity to share this with our audience and to be able to talk with you, too, about it. These apps, they identified during the course of a thing that they did to when they were trying to reach out to people they believed were wanting to have sexual relations with children, specifically 14-year-old children, or they believed that they were going to be 14. And so when the police department put this out and did this operation, they found that they were finding these predators using these apps. And this is just a short list of some of them. These aren't, of course, all the apps that are out there, but these are just some of them that they thought that they found actually were being used to solicit children.
Oh, my gosh. And this list itself, and I recognize most of the icons, and again, for our listeners, the website is enough.org, but I encourage you to go there and actually see this graphic, because so much of what we see on our children's phones, we recognize by sight. You may not recognize a name like Kik or Badu, but you'll recognize the imagery there. Are these the only apps, these 15 here, are we to assume that these are the only problematic apps that are out there for our kids?
Yeah, not at all. These were actually just the apps that they identified in this specific operation. There's so many more that aren't mentioned here. Some that we know kids use every day, like Twitter, you know, Facebook, although that's not as much used today by kids. But there's a whole host of other apps that are identified. And the point here is to be made that, you know, while a lot of kids will oftentimes come home and say to their parents, you know, hey, mom, hey, dad, look, all my friends are on these apps. Everybody's on them. Nobody else has a problem. You know, why can't I use them? The problem is that predators know that this is where kids hang out. And we know that where kids play, predators prey. And for that reason, it's so important that we create that awareness and let parents know that, hey, when your kids are using these apps, that there is a chance that, you know, through voice communication, through texting, through video messaging, that they could easily be put in contact by a predator who might ultimately use that occasion to start gaining the child's trust over the course of a grooming process. And what we're also finding is that police are telling us that, one, you know, a child may use a certain app where a predator reaches out to a child to groom them in that process, and then later on may switch over to yet another app to get them to give them more information in hopes of either meeting up or sending sexually explicit photos or content that child may not have realized that they were, you know, being put in a position where they were being groomed this
right.
whole time.
And so, is this a problem that is equal for both young men and young women? I will say my daughter, who's almost 13, has a naturally suspicious bent. And maybe that's because she is my only girl and I have two boys. And she does not accept follow requests from anyone she does not know on Instagram. And Instagram is really her predominant social media profile. She loves to take photos. She loves to share her journey with her pony. But the boys, my oldest son in particular, the 15-year-old, is particularly, I think, prone to making sure that he has what everybody else has. So do we need to be equally concerned with our young women and our young men? Because I think some of us assume that it's just young women, just our daughters, that we need to be concerned about.
Yeah, and you bring up an excellent point, and hats off to your daughter, too, for saying that she does not accept requests from people that she does not know. That, of course, is something we would always encourage. If you don't know somebody in real life, don't meet up with them.
Right.
on you know, using these apps. And so to answer your question, yes, I think it should be something that we need to look out for children in general, regardless of whether it's your boy or a girl. And we know that, you know, predators are going to reach out to children and exploit them however they can. And we see that whether it's, you know, trying to meet up, or even find that in the world of sex trafficking. It's not just something that is prone that is experienced by girls.
Right.
Predators will certainly seek out whomever they would choose.
So I think one of the things that bothers me is the fact that a lot of these apps have location-enabled features, right? They have location sharing, which naturally we've been sort of led to believe by some of the monoliths in the technology community, whether that's Apple or any of the other developers of some of these particular apps, that we are going to get better service, we are going to have a better experience with our technology with this particular app if we enable location sharing features. But as I review this list, I have to tell you, Kathy, the fact that there is a location sharing feature with these particular apps really makes the hair on the back of my neck stand up. Is there a connectedness that you see with increase in use of particular apps and their ability to demonstrate or reveal location?
Yeah, it should make the hair on your neck stand up. We would always encourage parents to make sure first and foremost before ever letting a child have access to one of these apps to go on the device, set up parental controls, set up privacy settings so that, including things like location sharing, so that your child isn't put in a position where his or her whereabouts are known. I'll give you a quick example. I just came across today, Facebook just released their dating app. A dating platform on their Facebook. And now that to me would make it seem that it is open to any of its users. Now you only have to be 13 years old to use Facebook.
Yeah.
And so I mention that because we're now at a point where kids can go back and click on their phones and say, hey, I'd like to meet up with this person. And part of this app, they have actually put an in-app messaging feature that allows location sharing technology in hopes that later on, you know, the person that you're trying to connect with, you can say, hey, here's where we're going to meet. Again, why they would go down that road, I have no idea. It just seems like a bad idea all around. But certainly location sharing, shut them off. It doesn't do any good when it comes to using these particular apps.
So one of the features that I see that is common in this list of apps is things that are hidden or disappear. Now, Snapchat has always been a major red flag in our household, as has Whisper, because these are two apps that we hear our kids reference, again, one in middle school, one in high school. And to quote my husband, who has oversimplified it, but this is really what it comes down to, Snapchat's just a way to send naked pictures that disappear. Mm-hmm. And he's exactly right. Anything that can be memorialized for an instant and then completely scrubbed, or so we believe, from the internet, we think sort of gives us the moral ambiguity to maybe do things that we wouldn't ordinarily do and not knowing who's on the other end of the line. Same thing with Whisper. Anything that's an anonymous social network that promotes sharing secrets with strangers, or WhatsApp, which sends encrypted messages. These are things that are major red flags. But one of these apps, Kathy, is actually labeled a calculator app. Can you tell me about this?
Yeah, this, and unfortunately, the calculator percent app, there's others out there that are like this. Mm. And this particular app, it gives the appearance of looking like any normal calculator that you might have on your phone. However, the issue, as we know now, is that when you click into this app, it can take you into or allow you to hide photos and videos and files, even your browsing history. And so something that looks so seemingly innocent on the outside, again, like a calculator symbol, isn't actually what it appears to be.
Mm.
And for that reason, parents, we tell parents, please monitor when it comes to your child's access. Even if we do our due diligence and set up parental controls and set up privacy settings, you know, there are things like this that are going to continue to creep up. And we just have to be mindful of them, that these are out there.
So we've got just a couple of minutes left here, but I really want to end with what I think is, for our listeners, the most important question, which is, if we have a sense that our children are in danger, if we get information that leads us to believe they have already been in contact with somebody who could be a predator, what are the appropriate steps to take? And in the beginning, how can we prevent this from happening?
Right, right. Great question. Well, I'd always say, number one, don't delete the information so you have that evidence and information in front of you. If it's something that puts your child where he or she feels at harm or threatened, without doubt, report it to authorities. Let them know. You can also later report to the social networking site that they may have been using at the time. But in terms of prevention, I always, even with my own children, I always encourage, number one, open communication.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about their use on these apps. Talk about when they're allowed to use them, and set these rules, set rules and boundaries to let them know, hey, that this is what is okay, this is what's not okay. And when and if something does happen or something does come across their way that makes them feel threatened or uncomfortable or exposed, don't automatically get upset. Instead, hear them out and encourage them so that they feel comfortable coming to you and telling you, hey, here's what I just saw. So that way you can work together to hopefully prevent these situations in the future.
We have said that very often to our kids. We have said it is always better for you to come to mom and dad. We will not get upset.
Yeah.
We have your best interests in mind. I cannot encourage our listeners enough to go to enough.org. That's enough.org. And there you'll find some graphics, some very easy to remember images that will provide a very handy summary of some of the most problematic social media apps and other apps that your child may or may not be using right now on their smartphones or their tablets, as the case may be. Kathy Haddam, I am so glad that you came on. If you have a parting word for our audience, what's the one thing you could encourage them with?
Just be a part of your child's social media life and be engaged. And don't assume that just because they tell you they know what to look for or all is well, that it is. The most important thing you can do is be an active role in their digital world.
So we can't leave them to be trusted to run with the wolves. We have to sort of take advantage of the fact that while they are with us, we will do everything we can to keep them safe, which is also why I follow my kids on their social media platforms. Kathy Haddam has been my guest today. Enough is Enough is the organization. You have been listening to Washington Watch. I've been Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins on this edition. We'll talk to you next time.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.